when Jerry invited me to be a part of this father-son presentation, which only has 1 year history. Last year, someone from Abilene was invited, and his son, who they both teach at Abilene, John and Tim Willis. And so they suggested the same thing for this year, and to get a man and his son who both preach. And I was glad to do that and for the challenge of it. But I got to thinking that the subject matter for this class is about as appealing as somebody asking you to come home and watch their home movies. But at least we warned you in advance. We didn't surprise you. But what we're going to do, there's something much deeper involved than that. And what's involved that's more important than that is that we're hoping to use the progression through our family history. And if you can put up with it for and see the overview is to use that brief 80 or 90 years, most of this century, to use it as a microcosm through which to see the movement of which we're a part. There have been some enormous changes take place in the years of this 20th century. And as it has gradually and now increasingly approached a period of almost chaos, we're having to look at something that will give us some kind of an anchoring for a perspective. And we hope, Tim and I do, that by looking at the movement through a microcosm, a little handle on the future, or a handle on the present, or a handle on the past, that we can be able to help us gain perspective and sharpen our focus, and thereby help us know who we are and why we are, and to find out, if we can, where we're going. So that's what we're trying to do. Does that make sense? And we're going to do it through looking, and Tim will describe it more in detail just now, but let me just thank Pepperdine University for this opportunity, and thank you for being here today and for taking part in this with us. And we'll introduce it today and give you the overview, and then put some teeth in it tomorrow and the next day, hopefully giving us a perspective on where we're going and how we're going to get there. Tim?
Well, I'm grateful, too, to be a part of this and to be asked to work with Dad in presenting something on this topic. We've not done anything like this together before, so this is a first for us, but we're looking forward to it. There have been many best-selling books written on the stories of families. However, I'm not aware of any that have been written on the stories of preachers' families. If they are who they ought to be, the story is sometimes rather boring. You know, not a lot of sex, violence, and things of that nature. But this is going to be fun for us, and we hope insightful for you. Will Durant, historian, has once said that all of history can be told either the story of great events or the story of great personalities. And I think by that he meant that you can either talk about what has happened in history, or you can talk about who has happened. I don't know if any of you are Missioner fans, but if you are, you know the value of talking about history through the use of saga, where you take a particular clan or family or tribe and follow them over an extended period of time to notice what happens to that family. But as you do, lo and behold, you're informed about a lot of things regarding the times in which they lived, the kind of country in which they lived in, the challenges they faced. So we're wanting to use a saga approach to the history of the last 100 years, particularly of our movement, and use the personalities of 3 preachers in our family, and a possible 4th in our family, to look at our movement, as Dad said. The characters of that saga are going to be drawn from our family, not because there's anything, nothing peculiar about our family, but not because there's anything spectacular about our family, but rather we are convinced, and have become more so as we've worked through this material, that our family can provide for us a window into the church that we all love. There are 3 generations of preachers in our family. And we want to use some 120 years of cumulative preaching experience in our family to as a way to comment on our movement and on where we've been, where we are now, and as Dad said, where we might be going. We want you to know that the story we have to tell over the next 3 days is not a story about our family. Now, today especially, you're going to hear quite a bit of biography. But if that's all we do, we will have failed in our purpose. We truly want to use our family as a vehicle to describe, discuss, talk about who we are as a people, the issues we love, the various ebb and flow of our movement. Because this is a generational study, we're going to be highlighting some of the differences between the generations. And in fact, as we go through this, we hope to raise in your minds some questions about, boy, with all of these differences, are we still the same church? In particular, as we look into the future, perhaps some dissonance is going to be raised in you as we look across the horizon of the next millennium and think about what kind of church we're becoming. But we also want to come back and talk about some commonalities, some points of similarity among the generations that let us know that, in fact, we are a part of one family that is moving in one unified direction, even if we don't always climb in the same vehicle to get there. So our hope is that we can create some understanding, and we can create perhaps a bit of insight that may serve you, may not. I hope that it does. Of course, I couldn't be here and be a part of this without throwing in some high tech, and as usually happens, the high tech always lets you down. However, we're going to be showing some slides, and because of the lighting, what we're going to do is simply take down the lights, show a montage of slides, bring the lights back up, and talk about it. And I hope you'll fix some of these images in your mind. Dad, if you would, man the space bar there. And Alex, if you could take the lights down, let me just introduce for you the characters that we'll be talking about during this time. This is the Talbert Fanning Woodruff family. If you look on the front row there, you will see Snazzy, Claude Harding Woodruff. We'll come back to him in a moment. This is Claude Harding as a young adult. He was a part of the church when the church had a clear sense of itself. He has worked with churches, as Dad will talk about, in a number of places. This is a... Okay. But Claude's church was a church that many of us look back upon with nostalgia. Dad's church, however, the church of his day was a bit of a different beast. And we're going to be looking at how Dad has served churches that, though they have their feet firmly planted in the church of the past, are really concerned to figure out how to reach into the present. The churches I've ministered to, and particularly this the last church, with the Westside Church, are churches that are quite dissimilar from the church of my grandfather, and in certain surface ways. But we are very concerned with how to reach the world we live in presently, and we're going to talk about that church as well. And then my son James, we want to think about what kind of church he might minister to, and what kind of concerns and challenges it will face. And I think we're going to have some fun playing with that possibility over the next few days. Let me turn things back to Dad now and let him take it over.
Tim talked about high tech, and he couldn't come without high tech. When I knew he was coming with high tech, I came with high tension. I've got high blood pressure, like most of you in here probably do, and let me make sure we're synchronized on time. Tim, let's see, 7:05, that's about 2:30. Okay, let me have just a few minutes to talk about this makes me nervous. I don't like to talk about myself, period. Certainly don't like to take people's time, but like I said, we've got a higher motive than that, so bear with us. My dad was born in 1896. He was born to Talbert Fanning and Telia Woodruff. Talbert Fanning Woodruff. What does that tell you about his grandfather? What does it tell you about my father's grandfather if my father's father was named Talbert Fanning Woodruff? It would tell you they must have been part of the Restoration Movement, the American Restoration Movement. My father's grandfather was a member of the American Restoration Movement. My father's grandfather was born in 1820. So that means that with James, your son, there are six generations of us in the American Restoration Movement. My dad was born in Spring Hill, Tennessee, 1896, at Spring Hill Orphanage. And I remember as a little boy saying, "Daddy, I didn't know you were an orphan." And he like being born at an orphanage would make him an orphan. So six generations. The world in which my father was born was a world where people plowed behind horses. In the light of the moon, maybe. But they plowed behind horses in order to plant by the sign of the moon. He left this earth at a time when people were planting their feet on the moon. The changes that took place between where he was born, when he was born, and when he died probably cover an expanse greater than any other generation that's ever lived. He, in his ministry, lived at a time and was old enough at the time when the changes began to come with such rapidity that he was old enough to just simply step back and not be caught up in the most recent changes. By the time you get to be 75 or 80, in your face, do what you want to. I don't have to do anything with you. I'll just go on about my business. He had the privilege of doing that, but he had advanced from manual typewriters to computers. I don't think he ever learned how to type, but he advanced from horses to cars to planes to rockets, and I was going to say he advanced from chalkboards to this display. Yeah. So we regressed in some ways. He was ambidextrous. He was ambidextrous. He could write with either hand. I've watched him preach many a sermon. I never preached without a blackboard. You know, those of you who are familiar with that age, you'd always have a blackboard. And if he happened to be on the left-hand side of the blackboard, he just used the other hand. He broke his arm cranking a Model T way back when we'll see Model T Lizzie in just a few minutes. But anyway, he lived at that particular time. He lived through one depression, two world wars, then the post-war boom. He lived through all of those things, and they were enormous changes. But the changes that took place originally in the earlier part of his life were so slow that you really didn't know you were going through a change. We're living in change now that's so rapid that you wonder if there's anything but change around us. But the churches of Christ during Claude Harding Woodruff's ministry reflect some of those changes, either in the sense that they reflect an effort to keep up with the changes, or they reflect an ignoring or probably just being oblivious to the changes. I was in debate with a man on the subject of divorce, and he said to me after the presentation that I made on divorce and that he had made, he asked me this question. Now, this was in about 1980 or 85. He said, "Where are you coming across all these divorced people?" Well, the man was not quite of my father's generation, but he was old enough to know better than to ask that kind of a question. Where are you coming across all these divorced people? What had happened in his trying to navigate the changes and the waters of change, he had decided to just bury his head in the sand and become oblivious to the fact that all these changes were taking place. The transition from a largely rural church to a city church took place during my father's lifetime. There had been a similar transition back in the Civil War days when the northern churches in the industrial north, they went through that. They went from a rural church to a city church. And it eventually ended up being the separation between the churches of Christ and the Christian church. We went through that once back in the Civil War days. We went through it again in my father's age, in his time, whenever we advanced from a rural church to a more city church. The movement had already experienced it once, and we were now experiencing it again. Christian colleges, better training for clergy, better educated membership, all of these things were taking place during my father's, the peak of his ministry. Tim asked me, how would you describe the church during that period? Those of you who are, how many of you are over, oh, well, that's not going to work. I wish I could get you to describe for me the church. See if you agree with this. The church during those times, say from the 40s through the 60s, that's 30 years. My father preached 70 years. But during the 40s, 50s, 60s, maybe even into the 70s, how would you describe the church? See if you agree with this and then add something to it. I would consider it parochial. And I mean by that nothing bad except that it was a Bible Belt church in many respects. The strength of it lay in the Bible Belt. It was tightly knit in the sense that we knew who we were. Our identity was intact. That we were in a period of certainty. And if we were not in a period of certainty, we were certain that we ought to be certain. That's right. And there, because we weren't certain, we were certain that we ought to be certain. We knew that we ought to stand for something. And at the same time that it solidified us, it also fragmented us. Because being certain that we ought to be certain, we were certain that you ought to be just as certain about something as I was and how I was. And because of that, not only did it make us certain in the sense that it solidified us, but it also fragmented us. Now, in terms of the history of his ministry, I've got a picture I want to show you that you're going to love. I think you will. If you don't, I'll be disappointed. He prepared for his ministry at the old Nashville Bible School. And how many of you know what is it today? David Lipscomb College. My dad was a part of the old Nashville Bible School. He attended it 1915 to 1916. Wish I had the picture up, but you'll see it in just a minute. Well, that's all right. Let's not interrupt this well-organized president. He had contact with more well-known preachers than any man I knew. He led singing for N.B. Hardiman, G.C. Brewer, all those great names. He was a great singer. One day one Thanksgiving, when all the family was together, Dan, you remember, we were all together for Thanksgiving. We started out that morning, Thanksgiving Day, with great songs of the church, and sang all 600 songs during that one day. Every one of them. We didn't know maybe 30% of them. Didn't matter. We all shape note read, if they were shape notes. But we sang those songs. And by the time supper came, we were all just saying, "How you doing?" We could hardly talk, but we sure did enjoy that singing. He worked mostly in the South, in Tennessee, Alabama, some in Georgia, but mostly in Tennessee. He was a student of the Bible. A man that wasn't afraid to read books across theological lines, I've got, but I only mention that because he loved the book Evenings with the Bible by Isaac Arendt. Isaac Arendt was a member of the Christian church. My dad didn't, as he would call it, didn't sashay out into too many theological other fields any further out than just the devotional works of people in the Christian church. But he was like you and me. He was inconsistent in some ways, but he loved that book, those books, Evenings with the Bible. And, of course, there were other books also along the same devotional line that were farther out, people, members of bodies of people that he didn't even know anything about, but he knew the books and the quality of them, and he didn't let their theological roots interfere with his enjoying their books. He was a lover of people. My daddy loved people, and they loved him. He had a way of endearing himself to them. At 85, and if you can imagine this, at 85 years of age, he was still going back, driving at 85, back across Middle Tennessee to West Tennessee, to Old Bion and Union City, to preach the funerals of people that he had known 40 years earlier. Now, Dan has that same ability to connect with people and to maintain and nourish relationships. I don't have that ability. I have a lady here, a very distinguished lady, who used to serve as my secretary. And if I could call her name, I would introduce her. That too well illustrates. It's Diane Carroll. She would tell you that if she were to be able to get up here, but I wouldn't dare let her up here. He married my mother in 1923. And I want to just close with making this statement, and then I've got a couple of minutes. Wherever they live, the church learned to love. I never have known my mother and dad to have been anywhere where the church did not prosper and grow in love where they were. And they went into some places that were ready to blow sky high. I remember he went to church in Columbia, South Carolina, and it was ready to blow sky high. And it wasn't 3 months from his preaching and mother's loving and her hot rolls that she had baked and carried to people. It wasn't 3 months before people were pouring down the aisles, confessing faults, crying, and loving one another. And that's the atmosphere. And when I think about growing up in the church during those days, I think about it from my mother and father's perspective, they always, the church was always better when they left than it was when they came. And that's really what it's all about. If you can teach people to love, and when you're loved, and then endear yourself to others so that they love you in return, and then learn to love each other, that's pretty good recommendation. And so that was my father. They begat five children, Dan and I. Dan's the oldest. Dan and I have ended up preaching. Dan preached for 30 years. I've preached for nearly 45 years. Then there was Betty and Jody, and we have a brother, Tom, who is never married. He was injured at birth, but the four who did marry married Christians. One married a preacher. They've got five children. It just kind of spread. But my father's ministry was one of ministering to people, and he was a man of the book. He loved the Bible. And this picture of him sitting there rubbing his forehead like that is one that's etched in my memory that I'll never forget. Okay, Alex, if you'll turn that down, I'll just comment on the pictures. This is my father. Go ahead and that's C.H. Woodward, Claude Harding, otherwise known as Snazzy. Dan's wife nicknamed him Snazzy because of the way he dressed. Okay, Tim, and this is, this is just a family tree. We did it so you'd have a visual of it. Daddy, Snazzy, is right there on the front row, Claude Harding. He was a twin, Claude and Maud. Sound like horses, but... This was his old Tin Lizzie. He drove this to South Georgia on a mission trip. When we were getting ready to go overseas to New Zealand, he made this one observation. He said, "Son, you don't have to cross the water to preach the gospel." I said, "Daddy, I can get to New Zealand today quicker than you could get to South Georgia in Tin Lizzie." He never said another word about it, but that was old Tin Lizzie. And then here's the picture. You see the white-haired, bearded man in the front row? That's David Lipscomb. You see the man, the third from the left on the back row? That's Claude Harding Woodruff. He was in one of the last classes of Brother Lipscomb, one of his preacher boy classes, and my dad was in there. I read that book and just saw him by chance. This is him with N.B. Hardiman. He and other men went up into the Northeast in mission work. But this is the picture that I think. Rob, did you not take this? It was Rob. Yeah, Rob took that picture, and it's a classic as far as I'm concerned. But that was my dad. He was known as a man of the book. His period of his church, we'll talk about in a few moments, but Tim... Yeah, that's me at a time. That's the genogram. That may have been, Okay, here's our family from in New Zealand. There's Louine on the left. My wife is here today. And my daughter. There's Beth, the one right next to her. And then John, and then Rachel on the right hand. And that's me on the back row. And then David and Tim. That was our picture of us while we were in New Zealand. And this is the mission team of our New Zealand crew. The Scotts and the Allisons and Waltons and the Woodruffs. There were about four families of us went to Christchurch, New Zealand in 1965. And then here's another phase of my work. There were two we'll talk about in just a moment. This was my work in the college church in Searcy, Arkansas. That's a lawn scene on the Harding campus. This is Jim and Louine in 1953. My goodness. A long time ago. Sure have changed. Okay, I think that may be it. Well, this is a list of the books. It's already been read. Rob talked about it, but we'll talk about that just briefly. Okay, let me have just a minute or two. Rob gave much of the incidental that I won't go back through. You've experienced most of the things I've experienced. Most of you here today have experienced the World War II. You've experienced you experienced the Depression, you experienced the Korean War, the Vietnam War, the Cold War. We've witnessed major sociological changes in the family. We've noticed the changes in the city. We've noticed the escalation of crime. We've just all experienced the bombing in Oklahoma City. So there's not a lot of that I need to relate to you, or I can't reveal much of anything to you. You've already experienced the things that I've experienced. As far as the prologue or some advance remarks about my own ministry, I never dreamed that I would ever preach. Never. My dad preached ever since I knew him. He's preached for 70 years. I've never known him to do anything else. But never once in all of my 17 years before I started thinking about preaching, I never dreamed I'd ever preach. I heard a 16-year-old boy preach one day from Mars Hill in Florence, Alabama. And for the first time in my life, I thought, well, And it was like a light turning on my brain. I thought, well, if you can do that, I can. But 37 years of weekend diarrhea have taught me that it's not my nature to be up in public. You know, really, before I, for the first 37 years of my ministry, every weekend I'd have dysentery. It would be this, whatever it is, turned inward to my gut, and it would take its toll there. It has been a joint ministry with my wife and five children. I made a decision in 1962 with three young men, three young boys. I made a decision that I was going to be a father first and a preacher second. It was the most important decision that I ever made, other than becoming a Christian and marrying the woman I married. The decision to be a father first and a preacher second was it. And many people said, I knew you were a second-rate preacher, and that's good enough. And I can handle that. I can handle that. I'm serious. But I can't handle being a second-rate father. I couldn't stand it. But I could handle the other. In fact, it had to be. I wouldn't have it any other way. And if it didn't work that way, I would do something else to support my family. But instead of detracting from my ministry, the fact that I made that decision enhanced my ministry. And thank God each of our children is a Christian, and each married a Christian mate. And they have 11 children that I'm praying for daily, that they also come to know the same Lord that I know and that you know. And anyway, I got a B.A. from David Lipscomb College in speech, minored in Bible and Greek, and then later on completed an M.A. at Harding Graduate School. There are two works that were pivotal works for me. One was New Zealand. And I know if there's anybody here from the college church in Searcy, they got sick of me talking about New Zealand. But it had made such an impact on me that I couldn't say anything but what I talked about it. So I started calling it, you know where. And they would laugh. They let me get by with that for about a couple of years, where I would just say, you know, it happened over you know where. And I wouldn't say New Zealand because they knew what I was talking about. It was there that Tim and I both worked through our faith. He worked through his faith as a 14-year-old man. I worked through it as a 37 or 38-year-old man. But we both were in the midst of working through our faith. My ministry was shaped by that work in New Zealand. The seven books here that are listed here, they were either written while I was there, or they were written about the work while I was there, or they were written about principles that I discovered in the work while I was there. All seven of them. Now that's awesome when you think about 1 5-year period in your life when your whole entire ministry was turned around and focused. But that's what happened. Richard Counts was there also. Richard, I don't know whether it impacted you like it did me or not, but you probably weren't as ignorant as I was when I went there. You grew up there. Okay. I came back once to report, and a woman said to me, oh, how wonderful it is, and what great faith you have to go 10,000 miles away from home and preach the gospel. I said, ma'am, it was really sheer ignorance. I said, if I ever go back, it'll be by faith. But that was one of the great turning points in my life. Then I came back having been prepared. The 5 years in New Zealand prepared me for the next 8 years when we started the college church in Searcy. And it was there for 8 years that I was allowed this great privilege of preaching to these thousands of teens for those 8 years. And it wrung everything out of me that I had. But I knew what to preach. I knew the message. And people would ask me, how in the world do you communicate with all these different people from all these different levels, educated and uneducated and local and transient, all this? I said, it's just a piece of cake. I said, I've learned what the key is. I've learned the common denominator. He's Jesus Christ. Everybody loves to hear about Jesus Christ. And I had met him in New Zealand, talking to a man the other day, a member of one of our very, very conservative parts of the church. And I told him, I said, you can be completely free, you can be completely at ease with me, I have no agenda except to hold on to Jesus Christ with both hands. And he looked at me with tears in his eyes, he said, I don't know that man. And I thought, my goodness, what a shame, but you know, I didn't know him either. I knew about him, but I didn't know him until I got to New Zealand and hit the brick wall. Christ was the common denominator. I consciously, in the church in Searcy, I consciously made the decision that I would not any longer speak to Christian audiences even as though they were believers. I decided I would address every audience of people as though they were unbelievers. Because guess what? So many of us are struggling to get through our faith and to our faith. And so many of those thousands of kids that came didn't have their faith. They had their parents' faith. J.P. Sanders is here at this lectureship right now. And last night I went up to him and showed him this a note in here that he was one of the chief influences in my life that determined my ministry. And it was because of a class, and I only remember one day of one class of his. But it was the day where he revealed his struggle as he went off to get his doctorate in philosophy and the struggle that he had in the wilderness trying to find out his personal faith in Jesus Christ. And he said, when I came out of that wilderness, he said, I knew where I was. I knew who he was. And I told him, I said, last night, I said, Brother Sanders, that one class probably set the tone of my ministry for my entire life because it made me realize that every person has to go into the wilderness and come out with his own personal faith. I grew up in a time when the church knew a lot about the church, but we didn't know all that much about Jesus Christ. We knew a whole lot about the church, but we couldn't agree on a lot of in the church. So as a result, we fragmented. But that's what characterized the church of my day, is that we knew a whole lot about the Bible. We knew a whole lot about the church, but we didn't know much about Christ. And the fragmentation of our movement was something that I reacted against. When I left college and went to the North Carolina and South Carolina areas, I left the Guardian, I left the Advocate, I left everything but my Greek text, my English text, and my pregnant wife, and we all went over there in a U-Haul trailer. And from that, it was a reaction against the divisiveness and the dividedness of the movement of which I was a part. It was away from a message that was church-centered, and it finally ended up in the joyful discovery of the message that is Christ himself. He is the message. What a great discovery that was. I couldn't quit shouting. I felt like I discovered the treasure that was worth selling everything on earth you have. My writings have unconsciously chronicled my odyssey. They probably chronicle both. And you talk about us being peculiar. We're a peculiar family. In fact, we're downright weird. And if any of you know Lagarde Smith, you know Lagarde? Yeah, he's a first cousin, so. So it runs in a lot of different directions, and some of us got more of it than others, but I'm proud of Lagarde and I'm thankful for him. You know, he's just a great thinker. All of this swirl that represents much of the content and many of the segments of the movement. His father was a very conservative man. Lagarde stands with one foot in both camps and often tries to straddle the fence and gets caught and rips his britches at times, but none of us is consistent, and we find ourselves a part of a movement that it's wonderful, it's heartbreaking, it's embarrassing at times, and yet I told a young man, I don't know where you could go to find the freedom and to have the basis for being what you ought to be any better than having it right where we've got it. And I don't know whether you're discouraged or encouraged, but perhaps you can get some clearer perspective by seeing this struggle and the tension and all and the resolution that's taken place in our family. Tim, I'm going to just stop there and tell it, if you can make any sense out of all that.
Well, you've been kind to listen to this story. To this point, I have just a little more to add, and then I want us to talk some about where this might lead us, where we could pursue some of this in the future. Let me begin with a little bit of personal history. I was born a poor black child in 1955 at Hickory, North Carolina. By the time I was 10, we had lived in North Carolina, South Carolina, Arkansas, Tennessee, and had just moved to New Zealand. I was convinced that preachers, like bank robbers, had to be constantly on the move. My first experience with preaching was at a little church in Franklin, Arkansas, about 90 miles north of where I was attending college, Harding. And I had no intention of becoming a preacher. I was majoring in speech at the time, subsequently changed to psychology, minored in Bible, and had enough Greek to minor in, actually. But I wasn't intending to preach, but a member of the Bible faculty there twisted my arm, and I started going up there and preached for them for 2 years. But I knew I wanted to do something else. As the son of a famous or infamous minister in the Church of Christ circles, I didn't want to play on that field.
I was going to go find my own niche, my own place. So I was going to go into psychology. I went to A&M, got a master's degree, went up to York, having met Julie there, and we taught at York for 2 years. I got sick to death of counseling freshman girls over their broken romances and figured I've got to do something else with my life. What am I going to do? Well, three things happened to me at York. Number one, I preached a fall meeting there and found out, lo and behold, I could preach, and I kind of liked doing it. Number two, I met James Hinkle. Wave, James. James, in the hagiography of my mind, you know, there's the Apostle Paul, and just under him come three men, James Hinkle, Glenn Gray, and Ron Stump, three of my co-workers over the years. But James has had a great influence on my life. He and I began doing Living in Harmony seminars all over the Midwest. We did a video series. It resulted in a book. We did a lot of good, and he just took me and encouraged me, and I'm not sure what he was seeing, but he thought there was something there, and I've been blessed by his friendship over the years. And the third great thing that happened to me was, with due apologies to those of you who are from states to the southern part of our country, one of the best things that happened to me was I got to move out of the Bible Belt. And I discovered that there was life outside of Churches of Christ in Tennessee and Arkansas. One of the things James told me when I first moved to York was, Tim, up here we know who the enemy is. And I discovered that was true in many and diverse ways. And I discovered I really liked that. And so Julie and I moved to Lincoln, and we began preaching there, worked there for 8 years with the church, and much of my thinking about ministry and about the church was shaped by that environment. Finally, after 8 years, we moved to Oregon, and the church at Westside has had a radical impact on me. Now, you need to understand right off the bat, and I want to tell you that the church at Westside doesn't look like some of the churches you may attend. We do some things in our worship that you might be uncomfortable with. We don't roll around in the aisles, but we have special music, and we do drama on occasion. We have a seeker service every week on a Sunday morning that's targeted right for people in our community. But what's exciting for me about Westside is the opportunity to be experimental, to try to build an entrepreneurial church, to find ways to deal with the issues that are facing the people I work with on a daily basis. And that's exciting to me. Now, I want to use that as just a springboard to talk about the movement of my day. Dad talked some about the movement of Snazzy's day. His own ministry has been shaped by the movement of his time. He inherited a church that knew a lot about the church, but was missing something in terms of personal faith and the message that was at the core of what church was to be about. The times in which I live have shaped also my ministry and my view of church. I don't know to what degree I can speak as representative of my generation, but to the degree I can I say something to you about what I think people of my age are thinking about the church? I love the church. I love it enough that I have given the last 15 years of my life to serving it. I'm intending to give a big chunk of what remains to serving it. I have had numerous opportunities to leave our church. I'm not going to do it, God willing. This is where I want to be. But you have to understand that I'm part of a generation that wants to make a difference. We want what we do to make a difference, especially when it comes to the core of our lives, and faith is at the core of our lives. A church that is not ambitious to make a difference in the community around it is a church that may merit my attendance, but it will not engage my enthusiasm and passion and talents. Do you hear that? We have little patience with a church that looks on the surface like some things the early church did, but fails to function with anything like that early church's power and life-changing dynamic. We are not looking for stability from our faith right now. We may, but right now we don't need stability from our faith. We need stimulation.
We need a view of faith that will so capture us and that can compete adequately with so many of the other gods that are calling us to bow down before them. We need that from our faith right now. And as I'm about the business of trying to build a church that deals with those kinds of issues and addresses that generation, the church that I'm working with is going to look different from the church that has addressed the challenges and issues of other generations. I want to tell you that there are three primary issues driving my vision of church. We're going to talk more about this tomorrow. One is the continuing decline of our culture. If you had forgotten it was in decline a week ago, was a hard reminder. But we are convinced that our culture is in decline. And that is creating in us an absolute sense of having no time for theological trivialities. You will not hear us debating issues that we do not believe to be central to our survival. When they're peripheral to that, we have no interest in them. And I know that makes us nervous, because some of those issues have been critical to us at times in the past. They no longer are. And I can apologize for that. I can tell you I wish it were different. Instead, I'm just telling you that's the way it is. And if you don't believe it, ask anybody who's under 40 in this audience. I have a suspicion many of you who are over 40 are recognizing that too. There is a growing sense of uncertainty that the model for church we've inherited is going to be a model that can work in today's world. We're recognizing we're going to have to rethink some things about church in order to be effective today. And one of the things that drives that is as we look out and we see the community church movement, and we see the effectiveness of some of the things they're doing, not just measured in terms of numbers, but measured in terms of their ability to impact people and change lives, we look at that with a bit of envy, and we think to ourselves, you know, if they can make that much of a difference, what's hindering us from doing that? I don't think there's a thing in the world that's hindering us from doing that, other than ourselves. Now, tomorrow, a little bit, the next day particularly, I want to introduce my son James to you. And I'm going to be suggesting some things about the church of his day. Because if, in fact, the things I'm feeling are characteristic of a wider group of people in the church today, as you project that on into the next millennium, what happens then? And I'm going to talk about, I don't know whether he's going to become a preacher. I'm certainly going to be proud of him no matter what he does. But if he becomes a preacher, think about what we could do the next 2 days to play with what that means for the church of the future. And we're going to try to look at that church through his eyes and through what I think will be his concerns. Now, just to close. You want to show the... Yeah, Alex, are you awake? Let's look real quick at a couple of pictures and... you can trace the line down through Snazzy, Dad and Mom, to me. There's something what I looked like at about the age of 20 when I was preaching for the church up in Franklin. I had hair. There's Julie and I on our wedding day. 1979, wasn't it, Julie? I mistyped. Here's the book that James and I did together. This is a picture of me preaching in the Lincoln Church when I had hair. For those of you who were here 2 years ago and saw my fly fishing, so I had to put that one in. I think it is possible, as we tell the story of our family, and as we do some reflection on the movement we're a part of, I think it is possible for some of us to look upon that story with great sense of sadness. And to see in the passing of faith and ministry from grandfather to father to son to his son, to see a gradual digression rather than a progression. And perhaps there will be some who see in this the unfolding of a kind of apostasy rather than as each generation grappling with how to speak truth to the generation God has given it. My hope, though, is that you will accept that each generation has honestly committed itself to being godly and to leading God's people in the directions they feel necessary for the day. And if you can accept that we are trying to be faithful, then I think a wonderful opportunity affords itself to us. Because as we look at how Snazzy tried to be faithful, as we look at how James tried to be faithful, as we look at how I tried to be faithful, and as we think about how might James attempt to be faithful, we're going to find that same passion exhibiting itself in a number of different ways. And the passion my son James will employ to be faithful in his day will not be the same, it won't come out the same way that my grandfather's passion expressed itself. But even though each expression may be unique, and though we're going to talk about the uniqueness of each expression, especially tomorrow, we're going to come back Friday and talk, hopefully, I hope, about the commonalities, the threads that weave themselves through each of these ministries. And as we look at the question of what does it mean to be faithful, how do you serve the church faithfully, and what kind of church results from that service, as we look at that, I hope that you will be able to see those few golden threads that weave themselves through each generation and that indicate that we are tied together, not perhaps by all the forms we employ, but certainly by the purposes we're pursuing as this one family tries to minister to the family of God.